English Listening Comprehension Test, Spring 2011 Advanced Level. This test is in four parts. Part 4 has separate directions. In Parts 1, 2, and 3, you will answer the questions asked in the booklet by choosing the best alternative answer according to what you have heard. Mark each answer on the optical answer sheet. The test is about to begin. Now you will hear Part 1 twice. First, listen to it straight through.
Louis Armstrong was one of the all-time jazz standouts. He was the son of a prostitute who grew up dirt poor in New Orleans, became a great artist and a world-class entertainer. He died back in 1971.
This is Beth Conan interviewing Louis Armstrong's biographer, Terry Teachout. And it's Louis Armstrong, right? That's how he said his name. That background from New Orleans does so much to inform, well, not just his music, but his character.
Yes, it was ingrained in him from earliest childhood. He was working when he was 7 years old, and then as a young boy, because he fired off a pistol on New Year's Eve in New Orleans, he spent a year and a half in what was called the Colored Waifs Home, a kind of reform school, orphan's home. That's where he really learned how to play the cornet.
And you draw a fascinating portrait of the neighborhood in which Louis Armstrong grew up, called Storytown.
Yes, jazz was beginning to be born. And he did play there, but he also made money hauling coal. And it was in fact on that November day in 1918, when World War I ended, that he cut his mule loose from his coal cart, took it home, went back to his mother and said, "Mother, the war is over, and now I'm going to be a musician."
And the rest, there are so many people who are so important to his life. But nevertheless, the first person we think about is the great Joe Oliver.
Yeah, Joe Oliver was one of the top jazz men in New Orleans when Armstrong was a boy. He later went to Chicago, which is where he came to fame, and he sent for Armstrong. Oliver had trouble with his gums and was beginning to weaken as a player. So he sends Armstrong a telegram down in New Orleans, and pretty much Armstrong took the next train up to Chicago. And ever after, Armstrong never, his loyalty to Oliver was never diminished. He was a true believer in the greatness of King Oliver, and Oliver shaped his style. Oliver taught him the importance of simplicity, of appealing to the people, and that was Armstrong's first commandment as a musician.
Also, Armstrong took risks. His technique, he was a much more schooled musician than we tend to think.
Oh yeah, Armstrong's technique was fairly homemade. He had some schooling at the Colored Waves home, but he didn't understand that if you really hold that horn up to your lips tight to get those high notes out, over the long run, you do damage to your lips, and he did. If you see any photograph of Armstrong from the later years of his life, you see how deeply scarred his lips are. They split fairly frequently, and there were periods when he simply couldn't play at all.
We talked about the people who played key roles in his life, King Oliver, obviously, but also a man named Joe Glazer.
Glazer was the man, a former partner of the gangster Al Capone back in the 20s. He'd set himself up as a manager, and Armstrong came to him in 1935. His career was at a standstill, and Armstrong said, "I want you to run my life as a musician." Glazer was the motivating force in his going on the radio, and so on.
And your book is filled with stories like this, about a man who was an incredibly generous spirit. Would you read this section from the book?
It was about 1956. I was about 13, and Louis Armstrong was in town. My brother had written a high school speech about Louis, and it had won an award. And so I was elected to call the hotel and see if we could meet him. I called the nice hotel in town, and they said, "I'm sorry, we don't take colored people." They directed me to a really working-class hotel to call there. I called, I asked for him. They put me right through to his room. He invited us down. He and his wife were having dinner in the room. They invited my parents, my brother and me, and he was wonderful, absolutely wonderful. They kept eating and talking. We took photos, they signed autographs, gave us tickets to the concert, free tickets. And when we got there during the break, he took us out to the bus and introduced us to some of the band members. He was wonderful.
Now listen to the same interview in six sections. Look at questions 1 and 2.
Louis Armstrong was one of the all-time jazz standouts. He was the son of a prostitute who grew up dirt poor in New Orleans, became a great artist and a world-class entertainer. He died back in 1971.
This is Beth Conan interviewing Louis Armstrong's biographer, Terry Teachout. And it's Louis Armstrong, right? That's how he said his name. That background from New Orleans does so much to inform, well, not just his music, but his character.
Yes, it was ingrained in him from earliest childhood. He was working when he was 7 years old, and then as a young boy, because he fired off a pistol on New Year's Eve in New Orleans, he spent a year and a half in what was called the Colored Waifs Home, a kind of reform school, orphan's home. That's where he really learned how to play the cornet.
Answer questions 1 and 2. Look at question 3.
And you draw a fascinating portrait of the neighborhood in which Louis Armstrong grew up, called Storytown.
Yes, jazz was beginning to be born. And he did play there, but he also made money hauling coal. And it was in fact on that November day in 1918, when World War I ended, that he cut his mule loose from his coal cart, took it home, went back to his mother and said, "Mother, the war is over, and now I'm going to be a musician."
Answer question 3, then look at questions 4 and 5.
And the rest, there are so many people who are so important to his life. But nevertheless, the first person we think about is the great Joe Oliver.
Yeah, Joe Oliver was one of the top jazz men in New Orleans when Armstrong was a boy. He later went to Chicago, which is where he came to fame, and he sent for Armstrong. Oliver had trouble with his gums and was beginning to weaken as a player. So he sends Armstrong a telegram down in New Orleans, and pretty much Armstrong took the next train up to Chicago. And ever after, Armstrong never, his loyalty to Oliver was never diminished. He was a true believer in the greatness of King Oliver, and Oliver shaped his style. Oliver taught him the importance of simplicity, of appealing to the people, and that was Armstrong's first commandment as a musician.
Answer questions 4 and 5. Look at questions 6 and 7.
Also, Armstrong took risks. His technique, he was a much more schooled musician than we tend to think.
Oh yeah, Armstrong's technique was fairly homemade. He had some schooling at the Colored Waifs home, But he didn't understand that if you really hold that horn up to your lips tight to get those high notes out, over the long run, you do damage to your lips. And he did. If you see any photograph of Armstrong from the later years of his life, you see how deeply scarred his lips are. They split fairly frequently, and there were periods when he simply couldn't play at all.
Answer questions 6 and 7, then look at question 8.
We talked about the people who played key roles in his life, King Oliver, obviously, but also a man named Joe Glazer.
Glazer was the man, former partner of the gangster Al Capone back in the 20s. He'd set himself up as a manager, and Armstrong came to him in 1935. His career was at a standstill, and Armstrong said, "I want you to run my life as a musician." Glazer was the motivating force in his going on the radio, and so on.
Answer question 8, look at questions 9 and 10.
And your book is filled with stories like this, about a man who was an incredibly generous spirit. Would you read this section from the book?
It was about 1956. I was about 13, and Louis Armstrong was in town. My brother had written a high school speech about Louis, and it had won an award. And so I was elected to call the hotel and see if we could meet him. I called the nice hotel in town, and they said, "I'm sorry, we don't take colored people." They directed me to a really working-class hotel to call there. I called, I asked for him. They put me right through to his room. He invited us down. He and his wife were having dinner in the room. They invited my parents, my brother and me, and he was wonderful, absolutely wonderful. They kept eating and talking. We took photos, they signed autographs, gave us tickets to the concert, free tickets. And when we got there during the break, he took us out to the bus and introduced us to some of the band members. He was wonderful.
Answer questions 9 and 10. This is the second part of the test. You will hear this part twice. Listen to this part straight through. We are most happy to have Muhammad Yunus to talk to us about microcredit in Bangladesh. Microcredit involves the loaning of very small amounts of money to extremely poor people. Muhammad Yunus was awarded the Nobel Peace Prize in 2006. We have Francis Knightbridge here to interview Dr. Yunus.
It's a pleasure, Dr. Yunus. I've got some questions from our listeners. The first one, do you think it's ethical to charge the poor interest and make a profit out of it?
In Bangladesh, our bank, Grameen Bank, charges the lowest rate among all microcredit programs. And yes, we make a profit.
Mm-hmm.
But Grameen Bank's owned by the borrowers, so when we make a profit, it goes back to the borrowers as dividends.
And the next question. Are microloans taking a hit because of the recession?
We use very local money that's going to the local poor, so there's no way the hit taken by the financial centres of the world could affect us. We don't see variations in repayment rates or anything like that. We're okay.
How would you help the world out of recession?
Well, the system failed us. There's no reason why we should revive it. We have to make absolutely sure that we don't go back to the same old way of doing things. Mm-hmm. We should be creating a new world order. That opportunity's got to be taken.
And then, microfinancing empowers Bangladeshi women. Is it driving cultural change?
I'd say the most dramatic thing that's happened in Bangladesh in the past 25 years is the total change in the status of women. And Graham and Bank focused on women because they're most likely to consider the family needs first.
Mm-hmm.
Now, this was a radical step in a traditional Muslim society.
Has technology, like the mobile phone, changed the lives of the poor?
Not yet, no, but it opens up the door for all kinds of cell phone-based activities. They're funded by loans to individual women, and these systems function as payphones in many rural areas.
Mm-hmm.
Now, the idea of a village phone lady is catching on, along with other low-cost, high-tech systems.
Have you ever found any corruption involving a Graham and Bank loan?
You know, we have cases of corruption. But Graham and Bank now has 28,000 staff, 8 million borrowers and 2,600 branches. And we lend out over $100 million each month and have a similar amount coming back.
Mm-hmm.
It's very easy to put money in your pocket. But the amazing thing is that cases of corruption are so rare.
Why has it been difficult to put microcredit schemes into place in Africa?
Actually, we have a program in Zambia, and we have absolutely no problem. If somebody says microcredit doesn't work around Africa, I wouldn't agree.
Mm.
I see it working.
Mm-hmm. Population growth contributes greatly to global poverty. What are your thoughts about the problem?
Well, 30 years back, Bangladeshi mothers had an average of 6.2 children. Today, the average is 3.1.
Mm-hmm.
So, the population growth rates come down drastically, and among many explanations is the empowerment of women. They became aware of their ability to handle their lives and make decisions.
Mm.
Microcredit's not a population program, but it's helped women see how they can live their own lives.
And finally, as individuals, what's the best thing we can do to get rid of poverty?
Well, make people believe that we can send poverty to museums. When I talk about it, people laugh and say, it's impossible. But when you don't believe something, you can't achieve it. In your mind's eye, you've got to imagine something and then make that imagination, that vision, achievable.
Mm-hmm.
Now listen to the same interview in five sections. Look at questions 11 and 12. We are most happy to have Muhammad Yunus to talk to us about microcredit in Bangladesh. Microcredit involves the loaning of very small amounts of money to extremely poor people. Muhammad Yunus was awarded the Nobel Peace Prize in 2006. We have Francis Knightbridge here to interview Dr. Yunus.
It's a pleasure, Dr. Yunus. I've got some questions from our listeners. The first one: do you think it's ethical to charge the poor interest and make a profit out of it?
In Bangladesh, our bank, Graham and Bank, charges the lowest rate among all microcredit programs. And yes, we make a profit.
Mm-hmm.
But Graham and Bank's owned by the borrowers, so when we make a profit, it goes back to the borrowers as dividends.
Answer questions 11 and 12, then look at questions 13 and 14.
And the next question. Are microloans taking a hit because of the recession?
We use very local money that's going to the local poor, so there's no way the hit taken by the financial centres of the world could affect us. We don't see variations in repayment rates or anything like that. We're okay.
How would you help the world out of recession?
Well, the system failed us. There's no reason why we should revive it. We have to make absolutely sure that we don't go back to the same old way of doing things. Mm-hmm. We should be creating a new world order. That opportunity's got to be taken.
Answer questions 13 and 14. Look at questions 15 and 16.
And then, microfinancing empowers Bangladeshi women. Is it driving cultural change?
I'd say the most dramatic thing that's happened in Bangladesh in the past 25 years is the total change in the status of women. And Graham and Bank focused on women because they're most likely to consider the family needs first.
Mm-hmm.
Now, this was a radical step in a traditional Muslim society.
Has technology, like the mobile phone, changed the lives of the poor?
Not yet, no, but it opens up the door for all kinds of cell phone-based activities. They're funded by loans to individual women, and these systems function as payphones in many rural areas.
Mm-hmm.
Now, the idea of a village phone lady is catching on, along with other low-cost, high-tech systems.
Answer questions 15 and 16, then look at questions 17 and 18.
Have you ever found any corruption involving a Graham and Bank loan?
You know, we have cases of corruption. But Graham and Bank now has 28,000 staff, 8 million borrowers and 2,600 branches. And we lend out over $100 million each month and have a similar amount coming back.
Mm-hmm.
It's very easy to put money in your pocket. But the amazing thing is that cases of corruption are so rare.
Why has it been difficult to put microcredit schemes into place in Africa?
Actually, we have a program in Zambia, and we have absolutely no problem. If somebody says microcredit doesn't work around Africa, I wouldn't agree.
Mm.
I see it working.
Mm-hmm.
Answer questions 17 and 18. Look at questions 19 and 20.
population growth contributes greatly to global poverty. What are your thoughts about the problem?
Well, 30 years back, Bangladeshi mothers had an average of 6.2 children. Today, the average is 3.1.
Mm-hmm.
So, the population growth rates come down drastically, and among many explanations is the empowerment of women. They became aware of their ability to handle their lives and make decisions. Microcredit's not a population program, but it's helped women see how they can live their own lives.
And finally, as individuals, what's the best thing we can do to get rid of poverty?
Well, make people believe that we can send poverty to museums. When I talk about it, people laugh and say, "It's impossible." But when you don't believe something, you can't achieve it. In your mind's eye, you've got to imagine something and then make that imagination, that vision, achievable.
Mm-hmm.
Answer questions 19 and 20. This is the third part of the test. In this part, you will hear five short dialogues. You will hear each of them once only. Look at question 21.
On your way to work this morning, did you happen to notice the traffic lights?
Yeah, they were all covered with snow and ice. That's not really usual when we get snow.
They say it's the new energy-efficient lights.
So, what's the problem?
Answer question 21, then look at question 22.
A Chinese snooker player won 276 beef and kidney pies in a snooker tournament. He's donated them to the city of Sheffield.
Why did he do that?
Answer question 22. Look at question 23.
Jack, do you realise there are more than 200 firefighters using 50 fire trucks and 5 aircraft to fight infernos at Londonderry near Sydney?
Yep, heard about it. Don't they have bushfires all over the place?
Around 80 of them. A lot of property's been destroyed.
And what's going to happen?
Answer question 23, then look at question 24.
You know, the National Weather Service has declared a high surf warning for the Bay Area for Thursday. Large swells coupled with a high tide are expected to roll along the coast way up on the beach where people usually sit. 17 to 19 feet swells are expected.
Do you think they'll hold the Mavericks surf contest on Thursday? Sounds like the conditions for surfing are just about right.
Answer question 24, look at question 25.
Down in London, the Royal Academy of Arts has run into a spot of trouble.
What's that?
Prince Hans Adam II, if I recall correctly, the Prince of Liechtenstein, he's put a stop to a major art exhibition at the Royal Academy. It was planned for autumn of next year.
And why would he do that, if it was already scheduled?
It's because British officials have held up the export of a Renaissance painting he bought in 2006.
Answer question 25. This is the fourth part of the test. It is a lecture. You will hear this twice. First, listen to this straight through.
Hello, I'm Nigel Hales, and I'm here to talk about how drinking cups of tea and coffee can prevent diabetes. Basically, a large body of evidence shows tea and coffee drinkers have a lower risk of developing type 2 diabetes. And according to researchers writing in the journal Archives of Internal Medicine, the protection may not be down to caffeine, since decaf coffee has the greatest effect, they say. They looked at 18 separate studies involving nearly 500,000 people. This analysis revealed that people who drink 3 or 4 cups of coffee or tea a day, they cut their risk by a fifth or more. The same amount of decaffeinated coffee had an even bigger effect, lowering risk by a third. That's what the researchers say. If these findings prove true, doctors may well start advising people to put the kettle on. Typically, type 2 diabetes starts after the age of 40, and having relatives with type 2 increases the risk of developing type 2 diabetes substantially. Another factor is probably much more important: fat around the internal organs such as the stomach and liver. This fat sends chemical signals to body cells in other organs, changing how these cells behave. Type 2 diabetes is treated with a healthy diet and increased physical activity. In addition to this, medication and/or insulin is often required. Lead researcher Dr. Rachel Huxley said, "They found that decaffeinated coffee protects even more, so the link is unlikely to be solely related to caffeine. Instead, other compounds in coffee and tea, including magnesium and antioxidants, may be involved. And the identification of the active components of these beverages would open up new therapeutic pathways for the primary prevention of type 2 diabetes." Other studies have also noted health benefits from coffee. Last week, at the American Association for Cancer Research meeting, researchers reported that coffee consumption reduced the risk of dying from prostate cancer. According to other studies, coffee may help thwart liver disease and strokes, where people become paralyzed. Coffee, it may well be, but you mustn't put off handling difficulties with your diet and getting enough physical activity. It would be high time to conduct research studies with real patients. The implications for the millions of individuals who have type 2 diabetes or who are at future risk of developing it would be substantial. India alone has 51 million diabetics. Diabetes drugs are a multi-billion dollar market, but none has shown real usefulness as a way to prevent the disease. Nonetheless, what we can be sure of is that the development of type 2 diabetes is strongly linked to lifestyle.
Now listen to the same lecture in 5 sections. After each section, you will have time to answer. Then you will go on to the next section. You will write in Finnish or Swedish. You must write your answers on the special answer sheet. Read question A. Question A. Listen to this and then answer the question.
Hello, I'm Nigel Hales, and I'm here to talk about how drinking cups of tea and coffee can prevent diabetes. Basically, a large body of evidence shows tea and coffee drinkers have a lower risk of developing type 2 diabetes. And according to researchers writing in the journal Archives of Internal Medicine, the protection may not be down to caffeine,
since decaf coffee has the greatest effect, they say. They looked at 18 separate studies involving nearly 500,000 people. This analysis revealed that people who drink 3 or 4 cups of coffee or tea a day, they cut their risk by a fifth or more. The same amount of decaffeinated coffee had an even bigger effect, lowering risk by a third. That's what the researchers say.
Read question B. Question B. Listen to this and then answer the question.
If these findings prove true, doctors may well start advising people to put the kettle on. Typically, type 2 diabetes starts after the age of 40. And having relatives with type 2 increases the risk of developing type 2 diabetes substantially. Another factor is probably much more important. Fat around the internal organs such as the stomach and liver. This fat sends chemical signals to body cells in other organs, changing how these cells behave. Type 2 diabetes is treated with a healthy diet and increased physical activity. In addition to this, medication and/or insulin is often required.
Read question C. Question C. Listen to this and then answer the question.
Lead researcher Dr. Rachel Huxley said, "They found that decaffeinated coffee protects even more, so the link is unlikely to be solely related to caffeine. Instead, other compounds in coffee and tea, including magnesium and antioxidants, may be involved. And the identification of the active components of these beverages would open up new therapeutic pathways for the primary prevention of type 2 diabetes."
Read question D. Question D. Listen to this and then answer the question.
Other studies have also noted health benefits from coffee. Last week, at the American Association for Cancer Research meeting, researchers reported that coffee consumption reduced the risk of dying from prostate cancer. According to other studies, coffee may help thwart liver disease and strokes, where people become paralyzed. Coffee it may well be, but you mustn't put off handling difficulties with your diet and getting enough physical activity.
Read question E. Question E. Listen to this and then answer the question.
It would be high time to conduct research studies with real patients. The implications for the millions of individuals who have type 2 diabetes or who are at future risk of developing it, would be substantial. India alone has 51 million diabetics. Diabetes drugs are a multi-billion dollar market, but none has shown real usefulness as a way to prevent the disease. Nonetheless, what we can be sure of is that the development of type 2 diabetes is strongly linked to lifestyle.
This is the end of the test. You will now have 8 minutes in which to blacken with a pencil the ovals indicating your answers and to check the written answers. Remember to make sure you have written the following information on your answer sheet: your name and number, and the name and number of your school. In addition, make sure that the information needed for the exam has been carefully marked in. Thank you.